friends, you have, many of you, in your hands cyclostyled or Xerox pamphlets that indicate the aspects of the subject we shall try to discuss together, some of the quotations on which that discussion is based, and our very title tells us that we are trying to see what two great traditions, or rather one great tradition and a particular aspect of it, have to teach us. Theosophy itself, which is ageless and does not belong to any particular period or state of society. Plato, who belonged to a great civilization which was getting into difficulties in his lifetime and whose contribution has remained as a foundation of thinking for centuries and centuries since he lived and wrote about 500 BC. But before we launch into all this, let us remember the occasion. It was mentioned by the first speaker. This week, on the 26th of January, will be the 50th anniversary, the Golden Jubilee of the day the Constitution of India came into force. It is therefore the Golden Jubilee of India as a republic. It was a free country as from August 47. It was a republic with a constitution as from 26 January 1950. It's a great occasion, and please believe that behind all the discussion, some of which may appear rather abstract, some of which may appear rather theoretical, there is still, in theosophical tradition, a great feeling for India as a special place, a special country, a special tradition in our world. One of the masters of wisdom wrote that they, the great masters of wisdom, who are above all personal identifications, nevertheless are imbued with a love for their motherland so deep and passionate that it has survived the universalizing effect of their studies and their sadhana. So, however we may appear to speak in certain terms for the purposes of discussion, behind it all remains the thing that in India is called Desha Bhakti, which is a much nicer word than patriotism, because it brings in the element of Bhakti. That devotion which puts oneself aside. What shall we say of the nature of the state? Is it simply a legal, a political arrangement? Especially, is it the same thing as what kind of government you have? Not in the least. We shall have something to say of democracy and its spiritual foundation. Nevertheless, not even the democratic form of government is the only possible or the best form at all times of a state. The state is a great brotherhood, a great fraternity of those who are alive now, those who have lived in the distant past, and generations yet to come. Macaulay, who had many eccentricities, nevertheless once wrote in a light-hearted poem, "Then none was for a party and all were for the state." This happy situation does not obtain very often. It's perhaps a poet's idealization of the best days of the Greco-Roman civilization. Yet, in her devotional reading, we also find the great Chinese mystic and philosopher Lao Tzu saying, "It was the highest goal of the ancients." We shall not have time to go into it today, but Indian tradition speaks of very great kings. In the fourth chapter of Notes on the Bhagavad Gita, Mr. Judge expounds a little those verses in the Gita which refer to Vivaswat, Manu, Ikshvaku and the Rajarshis. And he speaks of ancient kings, so ancient that they are far before the beginning of history. He says, there could be no rebellion even in thought, because reason for a complaint could not exist under their rule. Because the king was himself visibly a spiritual being full of wisdom and justice and compassion. Now, these may be dreams, perhaps, as Mr. Judge says, they are dim folk memories of a bygone and glorious cycle of time. But somewhere in the background of political thought, these dreams remain. Plato, arguing dialectically and logically through the 8 books of the Republic, has to put his final view, as it were, in a myth. He makes Socrates say that this is not the description of any actual city, but let us see what the ideal would be. This has to be kept in mind. This preface is by way of a warning also, that one evening's discussion between us, a lecture and whatever we manage to discuss together in the way of questions and answers, is not really going to exhaust a subject of this sort. And it's a subject that needs to be approached with the heart as well as the mind. Once, about the beginning of World War I, the English novelist Charles Morgan said about France, which was in military danger at the time, he said, "France is an idea necessary to civilization." In the same way, India is an idea necessary to human civilization and even human evolution, at least as long as we are in this cycle, what is called the fifth root race. In that broader context, and aware that we can't exhaust all that has to be understood, let us see some of the essential things. Now, as to the state and government, we said something about the state. And that it is not the government is elementary. It's one of the first things you are taught if you study political science at a college. You get a little short note to write on the difference between the state and the government. In the simplest terms, governments come and go. Governments can be good or bad. The state doesn't come and go like that. Even if a country is conquered, the state does not vanish. So, the state is one of those things which claims the loyalties of human hearts. There are certain things in life. Some things are principles, some things are great people, some are institutions which claim our loyalties, whether in fact we give the loyalty or not. These are things which have a right to our loyalty. The state is one of them. In the devotional reading which we heard, Lao Tzu, in passing, uses a wonderful phrase. He says, "If the great kingdom has no further desire than to bring men together and to nourish them, the small kingdom will exist." But just take that phrase by itself. No further desire than to bring men together and to nourish them. Now, this is the idea of the city. A city is not a collection of streets and buildings. There's a wonderful essay by the English novelist Charles Williams, "The Image of the City." What is a city for? St. Augustine thought it necessary to express his philosophy by writing a book called The City of God, Civitas Dei. Always, great philosophers have felt that the idea of the city, the idea of the state, is something which tells us about how human beings are to live together. Because live together they must. A life really isolated would be, as Locke said, nasty, brutish and short. A life in cooperation is the only one really possible for human beings. The state, as it were, is a vast and subtle means by which the cooperation of human beings is given a form, a great institutional structure. But what is that cooperation for? Plato says, as other great philosophers have said, it is that cooperation is so that the holiness, Plato uses the word, the holiness of each individual might be nourished and reflected in the actual life of the state. Theosophy would endorse this totally. Because in the first place, the individual is an immortal. The individual is a spiritual unit that undergoes experience in this mortal world. And all things in this mortal world perish sooner or later. States, civilizations, very continents are destroyed by geological changes. But the soul goes on. And so, as Patanjali said, the universe exists for the sake of the soul's experience and emancipation. So soul is involved with the world in order to gain experience. But it also has to seek its emancipation from the particular conditions which constitute a civilization, a culture, this period, the characteristics of that society, etc. There is a subtle razor's edge between these two things. Involvement for experience and emancipation of the soul itself. That's why Aristotle had to say that the state exists to hinder hindrances. There are things which hinder the development of the soul. In her Key to Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky was asked naturally these questions. The book is put in the form of question and answer, and the inquirer is represented as asking the question. And a question about, but what has Theosophy to say and do about the actual situation as it was then, late 19th century? And her answer is basically that it's a bad situation. The Western world might, in the last part of the 19th century, consider itself at the very front of progress so far historically achieved. It might suppose that the Industrial Revolution had brought it into an entirely new period of human development, all the rest of it. She just said it's a bad situation. Why? Because she points to the contrast. She says at one end you have lots of people living in such conditions that their mental, intellectual and moral development is hindered. At the other end, you are people who are not subject to conditions, but who in fact do not use their facilities and therefore also lose their moral and intellectual and spiritual development by indifference to the state of the less fortunate, by being indifferent to the point of driving the poorer classes into a condition which is terrible for mental and moral purposes also. So that she sees the economics, as it were, she sees the sociology in spiritual terms, and therefore at the end of towards the end of what proved to be her last message to theosophists, written in April 1891, she died on the 8th of May 1891, written in April 1891, there is a passage where she says, look, Western civilization is on the path of perishing because it will continue to sink into mere luxurious materialism. Civilizations have gone like that in the past. This will happen to this situation also. And the only way out of it, the only way to avert this catastrophe, is to overcome the terrible social distinctions, the hatred of class for class, competition between them. And then of course she appeals to theosophists. She says that theosophy can save our civilization from sinking into this luxurious materialism. And if students of theosophy individually feel they have gained anything from studying theosophy, let them spread it out of gratitude and for the sake of this civilization which is threatened by its own internal errors. But the state nevertheless matters in this, because individuals cannot be left alone to themselves. Now, how does a given society, a given country, a given civilization become what it is? I mean, we may say, for example, that our present condition is materialistic, or that it is full of law and order problems or crimes, or that there are too many tensions between countries and the threat of aggression and war. Why does this happen? It's not just governments and their foreign policies. That at one level. But what is it really? In The Key to Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky remarks that all things in humanity, meaning in human experience, have their roots in human character. Basically, it is the characters of individuals that determine what they do. Now, here, there are certain problems. For example, in the old Greek city-state, there was what you might call direct democracy. That is, when there was a big public question to be discussed, all the citizens of a city used to gather in the public square and people addressed them expressing their various points of view. The same thing happened if there was an important case. The accused, the accuser and the accused stated their, as it were, the points of view for the prosecution and defense, and the entire gathered community of citizens gave a verdict. But even this is not a panacea. It was exactly under this arrangement that Socrates was condemned to be given a cup of hemlock and put to death. It was exactly under this arrangement that various very good people were exiled from Athens. So that, on the one hand, at one point of Periclean Athens, a Greek could say with great pride, "I am the citizen of no mean city." Something very important to be able to say. But it was the public group that condemned Socrates. On the other hand, there is the problem which Montesquieu, the great French philosopher, he wrote a book called The Spirit of the Laws. He points out that when you have representative democracy, when the actual citizens elect or in one way or another choose representatives to govern them or to legislate for them in the first place, then he says, a little ironically, yes, this means that if the elections take place every 5 years, there's freedom for the citizens once in 5 years, and the rest of the time the freedom is only for the representatives, the legislators. This is a problem that exists. It has to be understood. But how shall we bring about social reform? All of us have feelings that our society should not be like this, that the poor should be looked after, that individuals should be free, that censorship should not be arbitrary, that there has to be a very good reason why some authority interferes with the publication of a book or the showing of a film or the production of a play. How is the whole thing going to happen? And of course, something which I'm sure haunts the minds of many Indians today: what about corruption? Well, Madame Blavatsky had a comment on that. It's there in one of those things printed in the leaflets you must have. She says, "To seek to achieve political reforms before we have effected a reform in human nature is like putting new wine into old bottles. Make men feel and recognize in their innermost hearts what is their real true duty to all men, and every old abuse of power, every iniquitous law in the national policy based on human, social or political selfishness." Please notice that selfishness can be human, social or political, "will disappear of itself. no lasting political reform can be ever achieved with the same selfish men at the head of affairs as of old. Now, I think many of us who are not very young must have observed and noticed this for themselves. You make a new law, you change the tax structure, you, let us say, make punishments for certain crimes more severe. And then what happens? I remember personally, about the time the Anti-Corruption Bureau was started, a few months later, a friend who had dealings with the police, so I said, well, at least now we have the Anti-Corruption Bureau, they will keep a check on corruption in the police. And the friend looked at me pityingly and said, look here, their rates are higher, that is all. That is to say, they expect bigger bribes than the ordinary police. Now, if public officials are willing to take bribes, or in fact demand them, and if citizens are willing to give them, changing the law has very little effect. This, therefore, which appears a kind of airy philosophical proposition, this insistence of HPB that the thing depends on changing human nature, this appears unrealistic and all that. HPB insists that that is the only practical thing to do. That the only practical way of changing a society, changing a state, is to change the individuals, their way of looking at life, their understanding. In short, character. If this is not done, all the technical methods of social or political reform are so much water down the drain. A number of you must have come across this situation. How old is the Sarda Act, which lays down a minimum age when a girl may be married? I'd be surprised if most of you have not come across servants in your own house who say, please lend me a little money because I am arranging my daughter's wedding. And you inquire, but how old is she? And it turns out that she's well below the limit of the Sarda Act. Who bothers? These things are done. It's not the law that is enough. There is a question of the law, there is a question of enforcement. Yes, that's a whole problem, but that comes later. So this is fundamental. And theosophy insists that the practical thing is also the moral point of view. That everything really happens under the law of karma. If the thoughts and feelings and actions of individuals are of a certain kind, then they will come together and produce a certain collective effect. There is such a thing as collective karma. And then, of course, individuals have to share in it. This is where the special responsibility of the king, the leader, the ruler, the social reformer comes in. That he takes account of collective karma, because he knows that what happens collectively is then also going to react on the individual. The starting point may have been a large number of individuals, but the effect is going to be via the collective situation. Why? Because none of us is wholly separated. The idea of an individual is one thing for the purposes of being a focus of moral conscience. It's only the individual who has a conscience. He can choose, he can think for himself. But it does not mean that he is separated from the community, the country, nor is any country separated from the world. To think that it is to be deluded by the physical appearance of things. If you grasp the processes of cause and effect, then the idea of separateness is a very unpractical delusion. Therefore, selfishness is also an unpractical delusion and an unpractical policy. Whether, as she calls it, it's human individual selfishness or social selfishness, a particular community wants to assert its special place or its special prosperity, or a country wants to assert what is called its hegemony, its special place in the world. Whichever it is, it is based on an essential factual error. Things are not separate like that. What happens in one corner of the world affects every other. Theosophy insists on this aspect of the situation. Therefore, whenever there is a question of discussing, but what shall we do? What kind of legal reform shall we have? What kind of social change should we advocate? Theosophy will say, look, nobody is going to lay down one hard and fast rule about this. It's not possible because nobody foresees all contexts and all situations. But a principle can be laid down. And if you are sincere, you can apply the principle honestly and do your best. And the simplest and most fundamental principle here is, anything that you start, a social adjustment, is it going to produce more brotherliness or less? Does it tend towards universal brotherhood, or does it tend towards crystallizing more and more little divisions? You apply that test honestly, sincerely, make whatever adjustments you can. Now, in all this, what remains then? The role of the ruler and the law. What is the state for? One explanation is that it is there to minimize the use of force. Now, this may sound paradoxical, because of course, in our world, unfortunately, a state is defined as the sort of entity that possesses an army of its own. Some of them, of course, most of us are not content with possessing armies. We of course also want navies and air forces, that I take for granted. They also want to possess nuclear deterrents. In the old days of the League of Nations, before the Second World War happened, Aldous Huxley pointed out, he has an interesting chapter on war in his book Ends and Means. He pointed out that if you look at the actual mechanism of the League of Nations, the practical situation, he says, a nation seems to be defined as a society prepared for war. Because if you don't have your own army, you're not recognized as a sovereign nation. The same situation obtains today after the bitter experience of World War II, after, if you ask me, the still more bitter experience of the Cold War. We still in the United Nations. Even India, a couple of years ago, why was it claiming a place on the Security Council? Because it had now had a nuclear explosion. Was that a good reason for claiming a place? If India deserves a place on the Security Council, it deserves it. For a quite different reason. It deserves it because it's the oldest uninterrupted culture in the world. It deserves it because it is the largest democracy in the world. These are arguments that you can support to some extent. Whether other people accept them or not is another matter. But to say that because now you've exploded a nuclear device, you should be put on the Security Council, is to cheapen the whole status of India as the unique thing which it is. It is unique because, as it happens in the whole world, no other civilization or culture has remained continuous for such a long period of time. There were glorious cultures, yes. But where is Egypt? Where is Sumer? Where is classical Greece? Where is imperial Rome? Where is even ancient and honorable China? They've all been interrupted and drastically changed. India alone, going through gradual changes, has yet retained something of a continuous development. Now, that's a good reason. But this thing about hope. Now, as I said, therefore, a state being associated with possessing an army, and in a given country, the state being entitled to do such things as award capital punishments, imprison people, etc., etc., the state becomes identified with force. Philosophically, actually, it's the other way around. Whether it is a modern state with its apparatus of judiciary, prisons and all that, whether it's an old fashioned king delivering judgment himself, as Solomon gives judgment, whichever it is, the point is so that ordinary individuals or groups don't fight one another by force. That any dispute is submitted to the state, because the state is an impartial judge, or is meant to be. That both sides accept in the first place that whatever they may think, whatever they may claim, there is an authority which will deliver impartial judgment, and they will both accept it. If that authority has to use force to some extent, it is only because there is imperfect obedience on the part of the citizen, or on the part of some group which is being rebellious. But that is not the essential idea. The essential idea is that the justice of the state is meant to wash out the need for disputes and fighting among people by themselves. This has both a positive and a negative side. The positive side, of course, and we'll come back to that great idea in Plato, the positive side is the concept of justice. The negative side is what the late Professor Harold Lusky once called the omnicompetence of the state. He had a sense of humor, and so he said that because of the state, a man may not marry his sister, and it's only by its grace that he's allowed to marry his cousin. Now, I think life is not so simple as that. Lasky was joking a little. But isn't it true that in many, many ways, the idea of right and wrong gets identified with the formal laws? This I call the negative side of the state's authority. But the positive side is there, that what force is available, what power is available within the country, within the community, is concentrated in an institution, so that it is not scattered among a lot of people who can then use it against one another. And that's why we have the wonderful image in the Raghuvamsha of the great king of the solar rays, Dilip, who's described, Kalidasa describes him, he says, Sena tasya parichada bhavuva dvayapi artha sadhane shastreshu akuntita matihi maurvi dhanushi chagata. This means that for him the army was like a lot of ceremonial retinue, a lot of ceremonial attendants, parichada. For the purposes of the state, he needed only two things: that intellect which was never baffled by any science, that intellect which operated in every direction, shastreshu akuntita mati maurvi dhanushi chatata, the string stretched on his own bow. This is a sort of ideal king who has both the understanding and the power to see justice done, to protect his people. Now, you won't always have a king like that. In fact, kingship is on its way out. These things happen in cycles. It's of no great importance. But then, that puts a different kind of burden on us. In one of Bernard Shaw's plays, a man from Switzerland is asked, "Oh, and what's your rank in your country?" Because the man who asks is being supercilious. He's a sort of proud aristocrat kind of person, I think. The man from Switzerland looks at him and says, "My rank? The highest known in my country, a citizen." Now, this is a tremendous idea. It is the idea behind the Republic. Why did Plato talk about the Republic? What is the reason why in the great days of Rome, Brutus thought it necessary even to assassinate his friend Julius Caesar rather than let the Republic collapse into a monarchy? That was Brutus' political motive. The rest of the story is not our purpose, to our purpose just now. The Republic, where the highest possible rank is that of a citizen. Very well. But then we must accept all the duties of the king. everything that is said in the great traditions about a king's power and duty. If we have the power, then we have the duties. Today we shan't be discussing what theosophy has often discussed admiringly. The great discourse on the duties or righteousness special to a king, Rajadharma, which is given by Bhishma, the dying grandsire, in the Shanti Parva of the Mahabharata. We don't have this, but if we want to consider what a citizen in a republic should be like, then he should be like an ideal king. That's the real answer. Now, this is a bit, I understand the fantasy or the fantastic nature of this. Bernard Shaw pointed that out also. He said, look here, it's all very well to say that in theory, a British admiral is a servant of the British public. But if any member of that public were to meet an admiral in his uniform and with his golden epaulets and his medals, it's very unlikely that the man would be able to stand up to the admiral. This is a situation that we have to accept and understand. It's a situation we have created. But the fact remains that a decent admiral obeys the decisions of the ministry, and the ministry obeys the verdict of the legislative body, in that case Parliament. When it does not, something collapses. In spite of all the miseries and all the failures of India since 47, this one thing we can at least be thankful for. I don't think we should be exactly proud of it, but we should be thankful for it. That we did produce an atmosphere, we did produce a culture within which the Indian army, the armed forces generally, have very quietly remained obedient to the civil power. Even when things were disturbed, even when an emergency was declared, the armed forces never attempted to say, we'll tell you what to do. Whereas much smaller armies in much smaller countries, in many, many parts of Africa and Asia, have done exactly that. Now, why haven't our armed forces done it? It's an interesting question. Because in terms of numbers and power, they have it. Not that they don't. Ultimately, it's a culture that does it. Time must be considered. So we'll also put this in the form of an ancient piece of symbolism. Yes, great kings, powerful kings, it's all very well. But whether it's here or in the old Hebrew Bible, when a sage, a prophet, walks into his court, a king who knows his duty comes down from his throne and walks forward a certain number of steps to receive him. That is to say, the secular power is subservient to the dharma, to whatever is the known cultural and spiritual tradition of that civilization. The civilization is going to stand or fall according to the quality of that culture. If not, if you forget this thing, which is sometimes called hierarchy, but that's a dangerous word, though it has a very wonderful philosophical meaning, or it's sometimes called degree. In Shakespeare, there is a wonderful speech which Shakespeare puts in the mouth of Ulysses in the play Troilus and Cressida. And Ulysses says, look, take away degree, untune that string. The metaphor that rises to Shakespeare's mind and he puts it in Ulysses' mouth is that it is like misadjusting the string in a musical instrument. Untune that string, degree. The proper subordination of one thing to another. And hark what discord follows. And there's a long passage and the thing ends by saying, each thing meets in mere occupancy. That is, everything we encounter, everything else, simply in terms of force and power. So the essence of the state, the essence of citizenship, the essence of kingship, the essence of understanding about collective karma is not power on these lower planes of reality, but order which exists by a cosmic sanction. Rita, dharma, whatever you call it, righteousness, that somehow these things must be brought to bear upon power and control it. The example of the armed forces obeying the parliament is only one trivial example of this far more basic situation, that somehow in a civilization, whatever is the best understanding of that civilization, of reality, truth, justice, must be brought to bear upon the actual institution, must be brought to bear upon people's notions of right and wrong, must be brought to bear upon what things are punished and what things are not punished, what things are rewarded, what things are forbidden. This whole situation must be governed. In short, the king must walk a few steps forward to greet the sage and the prophet. Where this situation does not exist, you can do what you like about it. Very intelligent men spend their time adjusting the tax laws. And the result is that in the next generation, some of the most intelligent students are taken away to find loopholes in those laws. This, unless the culture is such that it sees the subordination of material to moral things, the subordination of intellectual to spiritual perceptions, if this is not there, if this degree, this string is untuned, as Shakespeare made Ulysses say, then the encounter of one thing with another by force, the supreme argument against in favor of ahimsa or non-violence is that once you have violence, what is the guarantee that the right side will be stronger in terms of fighting? What is the guarantee? As Napoleon said, God will be on the side of the big battalions as far as winning battles goes. Of course, that's not the end. We know that karma will put the balance right in the long run. But the process may be one of great misery. The process may be one of immense sufferings for large numbers of people. Therefore, Plato began the discussion of the Republic by asking, what is justice? And he was realistic enough to have one of the disputants, one of the people in the dialogue, quickly say, I know, he said, Glaucon, he said, I know. Might is right, justice the interest of the strong. He was your realist, so to speak. And then a long part of the dialogue is devoted to Socrates cross-questioning him till he shows him that is not so, that justice, the idea of justice, the idea of universal harmony, exists on its own level with a tremendous power which cannot be changed. And that therefore, ultimately, it's the sort of man who understands justice in its own divine place, justice which exists. That sort of man can alone produce a kind of city, meaning a kind of state. In those days, city and state were almost the same thing. He can produce a social situation, as we would say, in which individuals and groups, communities, can reach forward to their own perfection. Not a perfection invented by some new theory, a perfection which is inherent in their own natures, in which they can fulfill what is already within them. That is why that famous statement of his, that you need kings who are philosophers, and you need philosophers to become kings. And that's why his comment, that naturally the philosopher won't want to be a king. You will have to go and beg him to be, persuade him to be a king. And there's so much more in the Republic that's profoundly suggestive. For example, that whole discussion, rulers, who should be the philosopher kings, guardians. You see his careful description of their discipline. And you wonder, isn't he really talking about the ideal Kshatriya? Workers, he talks about. And you wonder, isn't he really talking about the ideal Vaishyan children? Of course, he never uses caste terms, because he's not talking about these in terms of birth. It's a very interesting situation. Justice, therefore, is the soul of the state. And that justice is not an external thing. It's not a thing that you and I invent. We don't sort of say, but what percentage of income tax would be just? That is not the point. The point is that there is an inherent justice. There is some framework which will permit the soul within each man to express itself. Wordsworth, you remember, said, "The soul that rises with us, our life star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar." We don't invent anything like that. It's just there. We just have to recognize it. And it is this that leads forward to Plato's whole understanding of what a city should be. Naturally, there's a great deal that Plato wrote 8 books of the Republic, so we haven't said very much. There are 8 sections in it. Let us close this, though the time is past really, by recommending to you 3 brief articles which were originally published in the journal The Aryan Path and have been reprinted in a book called Thus Have I Heard, which unfortunately is out of print this minute, but copies are available in the library. There's one article called Politicians Need Philosophy. There's another called Leadership in a Republic. This was an article written just a few days. It was written really for the 1st of January in 1950, when we were all looking forward to the first promulgation of the Constitution. Leadership in a Republic. And there's another called True Democracy, which discusses what Lincoln really meant by saying democracy is government of the people, by the people.